Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Friday, October the 26th. And as we like to do, as we get close to the election, we're going to touch base tonight with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. And we're going to take a look at the big picture, and then we're going to look at some of the Senate races and maybe some of the House races that Barry is following. But I know the Senate is extremely interesting and the House is extremely interesting. In fact, there's a lot of interest in this election from some of the early voting that we're seeing, obviously, from the interest of the President of the United States, who I think has really committed himself to protecting the House majority as well as increasing the Senate majority. I have not seen, and I've been following these elections probably going back to 1970, 72. I have not seen an incumbent president get out there and fight for his party. I've never seen quite like this before. Maybe there's another example that I missed, but I don't remember anybody doing this, and I think that's a credit to President Trump, not only in his intentions, but also his effectiveness, because it does seem like when he gets out, it does motivate the Republican base. Let me say hello to our friend Barry Castleman. How are you, Mr. Prairie Editor?
I'm good, thank you.
You know, the last time you were on, I had an email from a listener who's a friend as well, and he wanted to know a little bit more about your background. So I just thought maybe if you could take a second and share with us your story, and I know you have a tremendous amount of experience in following elections, so if you could just kind of do a quick biography for some of our listeners, Barry.
Well, I hadn't planned on it. I'll simply say that I've been covering politics. My first presidential election was 1972, and my first election newspaper coverage was 1971, so I've been doing it a long time. I've never had a journalism course in my life, but I've been a journalist for almost 50 years. I actually am a literary writer by background. I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I've written books of poetry and fiction. But I make my living writing about national and international politics and public policy. I have many interests, and I started my blog around 2008, The Prairie Editor. Before that, I published a newspaper very similar to the city papers that you have in Houston and Dallas and Fort Worth and all across the country. There's these weekly newspapers. I was a pioneer with that in the early 70s and locally here in Minnesota. And I have many interests, and I'm getting to be an old guy now, but I'm as busy as I've ever been.
Well, this is for my friend Tomas, who had requested that. There you have it, the story of the Prairie Editor for my good friend Tomas, who had sent me that email the last time you were on. Well, let's talk about this amazing election, and as I said, we're going to look at the big picture. We're going to look at in the second segment, we'll look at some of the actual individual races that you're following at the Prairie Editor. I mentioned in my introduction that there's a lot of interest in this election. At least that's what I sense. And that I have never seen a president get this active in protecting a House majority as well as trying to increase his Senate majority. You've been doing this a heck of a lot longer than I have. Have you ever seen an incumbent president get this active in campaigning, Barry?
No, and in fact, the president has successfully nationalized the race, something that the Democrats, I think, did not want to happen, although I guess they are not unwilling to enter the battlefield with it, because the president is clearly the issue on both sides. So the people who don't like the president are motivated, the Democrats, and the people who love the president and agree with him are motivated on the Republican side. And the fact of the matter is that this election is more about President Trump than anything else. And I think that in that battlefield, the advantage is slightly to the president.
But
it depends, of course, where you are. In the so-called blue states, the president is not popular, and that will help Democratic candidates. But most of the competitive races are in red states, where the president is popular, and he is motivating his supporters. And therefore,
that's right.
At the very end of the campaign, it appears, I say it appears, we won't know anything for sure until election night, but it appears that the trend is towards Republican candidates in the close races, especially in the Senate, which I gather you and I will get to later in the program.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in the second segment, because you're going to share with us the ones that you're following, as you've done in other programs. Let me run through some general things about the midterms, things that we hear in the media that I'm sure you hear the same. The first one is about early voting. There's a lot of talk about early voting here in Texas. We had a lot of early voting on day one. It's been coming down since, but it's still, you know, it's still impressive that people get out to vote. Here it seems to be favoring Republicans, although I'm not exactly sure what that means. So when you hear about early voting results, Barry, what does that tell you, or does it even tell you anything about the outcome?
Well, I don't know what it tells us about the outcome. It tells us a lot about interest, and there can be no question. As I said, the election's been nationalized, therefore the on both sides. So we know that there's going to be a relatively high vote in a midterm election. Normally, it's not as high as a presidential election. It probably won't be that high, but it'll still be very high. Number two, when they say that there are more Republicans or more Democrats voting in early voting, they're guessing. They're basing it on party registration, which isn't, by the way, available in all states. It's not available in Minnesota, where, by the way, we've had a very high early voting. But I make the following point. It's more convenient for some people to vote early, and I think that would tend to make the vote larger. I agree with that. But the fact of the matter is that if you vote early, you don't vote later. So early voting is a convenience. I have questions about, you know, voter ID and, you know, the steps that are taken not only to avoid fraudulent voting, but to avoid hacking, which seems to be a new issue in voting. And so I think that I'm much more concerned about any irregularities or improper voting than I am about anything about early voting. Early voting is, like absentee ballots, absentee ballots are a long time tradition, but I don't think it tells us much more than that there's a keen interest in the election. And we already know that.
And that's right. We knew that from the beginning, because this is one of those midterms where people are excited on both sides. Now, let's take a look at the big picture, the excitement and so on. This is the conventional wisdom. This is what we're hearing about the excitement. So just tell me if you agree or disagree with me. People were saying, let's say, up to about a month ago before the Judge Kavanaugh hearings, that the Democrat excitement was through the roof and Republicans were not as excited to vote, let's say. The Kavanaugh hearings apparently have turned that around, and now the level of excitement is at least, one-on-one, depending, again, on what state you're talking about. Now here at the end of the campaign, with a couple of weeks to go, a couple of big issues have apparently, certainly our friend Newt Gingrich says that this campaign is going to be about the caravan and Kavanaugh, and he believes that that's going to help the Republicans. Do you generally agree with that reasoning or that conventional wisdom that both parties have, the same level of excitement right now as they didn't a month ago, but they do now, Barry?
Well, I would say that 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago, that clearly the Democrats were more excited. They were anti-Trump, and they were going to express themselves. I think today there's more excitement on the Republican side, thanks to Kavanaugh, thanks to the caravan, but most of all, thanks to the President of the United States. Those rallies, and you've had one down in Texas, and we've had two here in Minnesota, are drawing crowds like nobody has seen. And Joe Biden went to Nevada and got 500 people, and the president went there and got 20,000. I mean, what does that tell you?
That's right.
It doesn't necessarily always translate to votes, and mm-hmm. I want to be cautious about drawing any conclusions of certainty. And I think that definitely the Democrats have the advantage in the races for the House of Representatives. Whether mm-hmm. they'll take a majority, win back control or not, is an open question. But it's certainly a definite possibility, considering mm-hmm. the number of competitive races. By the way, I don't think the number of competitive races are as many as many of the pundits are suggesting. They're mm-hmm. basing that on speculation, wishful thinking, and some very unreliable polling.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are anywhere from 25 to 35 House seats that are genuinely up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of those are have Republican incumbents. So mm-hmm. there's no question the advantage in the House is to the Democrats, just as the same kind of advantage, mathematical, is to the Republicans in the Senate, where they seem to be not only have more opportunities, but they seem to be doing much better.
Right. Well, let me ask you another general question about the overall state of the midterms. People talk about waves, okay? They talk about a blue wave, a red wave, and the consensus, or at least what many of the experts were saying a month ago, is that it was just going to be a blue wave. Now they're saying, well, not necessarily a blue wave. There may be a red wave as well. So if you have a red wave and if you have a blue wave, do you have any waves at all? I mean, because a wave is, as I'm familiar with, let's say in 2010, when there was a huge wave against President Obama, even in 2014, in 1994 against President Clinton, in 2006 against President Bush, and so on and so on. A wave usually means that one party outperforms the other, but if both parties are excited, and let's say, for example, at the end of the day, the Republicans pick up seats in the Senate, and even if the Democrats were to pick up the House, how could you have two waves like that produce a House for the Republic for the Democrats and a Senate for the Republicans, Barry?
Well, first of all, it's not going to be a wave, red or blue. There's going to be a surge, maybe, blue or red, or there might be what I call the white wave. The white wave means neutral. I think that's probably the most likely wave, mm-hmm. is a white wave, which means that the Republicans will pick up anywhere from 2 to 6 seats mm-hmm. in the Senate, and the Democrats will pick up anywhere from 15 to 35 seats in the House.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my ranges. I don't know where they are in the end, and they could be slightly outside those ranges either way. But and then there's, of course, the governorships, which, again, the Republicans, the Democrats have a distinct advantage because there's so many more Republican governors up for re-election.
Exactly.
But there's going to be some surprises. Alaska, maybe even near Minnesota, you're going to see Republican pick up Democratic governorships. So it's a very complex election. Unique in many ways. But the two parties are undergoing a realignment. President Trump has realigned the Republican Party, and the left is realigning the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders,
that's right.
Elizabeth Warren and Maxine Waters, Winks, are all turning the Democratic Party upside down and putting Biden and Clinton and Manchin and all the moderates on their fannies in their own party. And so you have a very interesting confluence of factors. You have that realignment, you have the president, you have Bernie Sanders, you have the neo-socialists, you have the Freedom Caucus on the right. You've got all kinds of interesting complexities which make the polarities in the in voter sentiment all the more aggravated and exaggerated. So I have done something this time that I haven't done for many, many cycles. I actually got a reputation for being very, not always, but being generally very successful, especially in 2010, of predicting. Well, it's very tempting, especially when you've had success, to keep going, thinking that you can keep doing it. Well, I'm not doing it this year. I have your reader, your listeners, and my readers know I have rather scrupulously avoided making predictions because I realize there's this complexity and these many forces vying for voter attention and voter sentiment. And I don't know, I don't think I'm so smart that I can second-guess the voters.
Right. And, interesting. Very good.
And I think the voters are going to speak on a week from this coming Tuesday. We're only eight or nine, we're only about seven campaign days away, only 8 or 9 days. I mean, we're at the end here. And the voters are making up their minds. The undecided voters are making up their minds right now. And the races are tightening everywhere. What we see in this is that in red states, the votes are tightening towards the Republicans. And in blue states, the voters are tightening towards the Democrats. The point I'm making, however, is that there are more red states with competitive races, which is both a risk for the Republicans, but also their advantage, especially if the president can invigorate the voters and motivate them to turn out at the very end.
That's right. Excellent. Let me just ask you two very quick general questions, and we'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll look at specific races that you are following. And I want to get your feedback on this because we've been hearing, and I follow this quite closely, but I want to hear what you have to say. We've been hearing a great deal about a certain disappointment in the Hispanic vote with Democrats, that Democrats don't feel as if the Hispanic vote is going the way they had planned it would go. Now, my own personal theory on that is that I don't think the Democrats have given the Hispanics a message, economic or whatever. And, you know, there's only so many times that you can blame Trump or call Trump a racist or you can say this or this about Trump. At some point in time, you know, when you criticize Trump, you also have to remember that Hispanics are living in a very good economy. And they're looking at their economy and they're saying, well, gee, my jobs are here. My economy is doing better. So that tends to help Trump. And so are you hearing the same thing from your sources that the Hispanic vote is not going the way the Democrats had planned it, Barry?
Well, I would always defer to you with your your own Hispanic community tradition to have your antennae more sensitive than mine. I do hear that the Hispanic community, which is, by the way, very complex.
That's it.
Some of it's Cuban American, which is your tradition. There's some Puerto Rican American. There's some that is South American or Central American.
That's
even
right.
Some Spanish American. We have a small Spanish American community here in Minnesota, and a large Hispanic community. Also, my understanding, especially older Hispanic Americans, are very conservative in their in their viewpoints, their social views, and their, their religious and political views. And therefore, even though many of them vote Democratic, they have been increasingly turned off by some of the more extreme left rhetoric, especially those who've come from Cuba, where you had a left-wing dictatorship. They don't particularly appreciate these young legislators in New York and even in Minnesota, who are espousing socialist views, because they know firsthand that doesn't work. It's a failure.
Right.
It's a disaster.
That's right.
And so, and the other thing is, I give credit to President Trump on this score. In both the black community, he has reached out. He did it in the presidential campaign against everyone's advice because he said that there were no votes there. And he said, I don't care whether there are votes there. I'm going to do this because this is what the tradition is of the Republican Party, especially in terms of the black community, but certainly also in the Hispanic community. And we see in Florida, for example, we're going to talk about the Senate race later, but in the gubernatorial race, where you have a black mayor Democrat, but you also have Mr. DeSantis, who has made an extraordinary appeal to the Puerto Rican community. He spent time in Puerto Rico. He is identified with them. And he's going to do very well among not only Puerto Rican, but Cuban-American, especially older Cuban-American voters, which are normally Democratic. So where's the vote for the Democrat? I mean, the polls are misleading. I'm not saying I'm going to predict the outcomes, because those races are toss-ups. But I think that anyone who thinks that, those races are over are making a big mistake, as is probably the case in almost all the competitive races this year. I think we're getting surprises. We'll get to them in the next part. I mean, we'll look at Michigan.
Yeah, we're
going to
look at
New Jersey.
Many of those.
We have
races
here that we never expected. Here in Minnesota, in an attorney general's race, which was a slam dunk for the Democrats, and now it looks like they're going to lose it.
Exactly. No, we're going to get into some of those surprises in a minute, because you're right. There's things happening here in the in these last 10 days that are could be a lot of surprises. We're going to take a break, but I'll just say one quick thing about the big mistake that the Democrats, I think, are making with the Hispanic vote. You touched on it a little bit, the idea that we're all the same, that Hispanics are all the same, that we're just one group. And in fact, I think you mentioned the Cubans, the Puerto Ricans. I also think there's a sizable Colombian professional community in the United States that is more conservative, more middle class. There's a lot of small business owners in the Hispanic community, and I think the messages of President Trump and the economy, I believe, play well there. We had a special election down here in Texas a few weeks ago where Pete Flores won a Democrat district. This is a state senate, but it was very significant because he ran on a campaign, a very tough campaign on values, and on, like, he ran against abortion and so on. And he did very well with Hispanics in a district that was 71% Hispanic. So that's, for a Republican, that was quite a performance. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll get into some of the specific races and some of those surprises that Barry's talking about. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our good friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. In the first part of the show, we took a big picture look at the election. Now we're going to look at specific races, and this is one of the great things that Barry does in the Prairie Editor, his website. We're going to be looking at races that he's following, races particularly in the U.S. Senate, maybe in the House, a few governors. So let me bring Barry back on the show. Barry, I'm just going to tell you to take it away and take us, give us a tour, if you will, a political tour of what you're seeing politically in the Senate, in the governors, and so on. So I'll let you start any way you like.
Well, as I have written every year, every cycle, as we get close to the end, I say, now get ready for some surprises. Races that you thought were safe on both sides are going to change dramatically very quickly. And then in this particular cycle, I cited two. This was several weeks ago. Hardly anybody else had called attention. I'm not saying I was the first by any means, but I was certainly very early. And I said two races that are considered slam dunks for the Democrats are New Jersey and Michigan, with Senator Menendez in New Jersey and Senator Stabenow in Michigan. And neither of them at that point, this is back way back when I first called, keeping an eye on it, but there were no opponents yet. They hadn't had their primaries. And, of course, without an opponent, these two longtime elected officials looked pretty solid. Now, Menendez had a problem because he'd been through a trial which resulted in a hung jury, but his reputation has been shattered for alleged corruption, and there's not much to be said on his behalf, frankly, but he still was the incumbent. He had no opponent. Well, in each of the races, an opponent appeared that wasn't just an opponent, but a really outstanding competitor. In New Jersey, a businessman, a multimillionaire businessman who was willing to spend $30 million of his own money, Bob Hugin, got in the race and went after Mr. Menendez. This is in an extremely blue state. Hillary carried it by 16 points. And he is in trouble. Now, the polls show him with a small single-digit lead, but I wonder, you know, as I pointed out to you before the show started, the largest Hispanic group in the state, which is nonpartisan, but which has never endorsed a Republican. Now, mind you, it's an Hispanic group. It looks out for Hispanic interests in New Jersey. And, of course, Menendez is an Hispanic American. They endorsed Hugin today, as have maybe around 50 Democratic local leaders throughout the state at the city council, mayor, party chair, city council level. It's a phenomenon. So he's in real trouble. Chuck Schumer, the Republican leader, has put $5.8 million in this last 2 weeks alone to salvage this race. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but I think Menendez could be the big surprise loser of this election, a seat that was considered absolutely safe, in which Schumer has now has to divert very important funds. He doesn't have unlimited funds. He's got a lot of money. But that money was needed in West Virginia and Indiana and Montana and Missouri, and that money isn't going there. Now, in Michigan, it's a bit of more of a long shot, but Stabenow, who is a longtime member of the Senate, but not a very distinguished, she hasn't done much legislation. She's not a leader. She's not a high-profile person. She's just there. But she's been there. But she didn't have an opponent. Well, then there was a primary, and there was an upset, and a young, very charismatic black West Point graduate, war hero, state treasurer, so he's already run statewide, named John James won. And in the first poll, he was 17 points behind. Well, the latest poll only a month and a half or 2 months later, he's down to 7 and going lower. It's getting very tight. And he may come up short, but he may pull it off. I don't know. And the point I'm making is, as a black, charismatic black candidate, a man of impeccable integrity and very, very articulate and eloquent, what is the largest block of Democratic voters in the state of Michigan? Well, in Detroit, it's black voters.
Right.
Senator Stabenow is not a black woman. She is not black, but Mr. James is, and he's the kind of hero figure that blacks can admire and respect and want to emulate. So anything could happen in that race. I'm not predicting an upset, but it's certainly possible.
Well, he's very charismatic, like you're saying. This is the thing about John. For those who are not familiar with Mr. James, West Point graduate, the man is a super impressive person. Just absolutely super impressive, very telegenic. I mean, just well-spoken. The man is absolutely amazing. And you're exactly right. Compared to Senator Stabenow, who is really very low-key, not a very distinguished senator. I mean, that's a turnout election as far as I can tell. I mean, tell me what the turnout is going to be, and I'll tell you that he's got a pretty good chance of winning. But if he can go into Detroit and turn on or at least tell, you know, some black people in Detroit to consider giving him their vote, I mean, my guess is that Senator Stabenow, I know she's got my guess is that the black leadership in Michigan is heavily Democrat, but they haven't exactly performed for black Americans, which is the same problem they have with Hispanics. They haven't really performed. They do a lot of talking, but they don't really have great results, especially not with the American economy going the way it is, Barry.
Well, and who has had success? Well, President Trump, under his administration, has reduced black and Hispanic unemployment to record levels.
Exactly.
Never happened under Obama. It frankly didn't happen under George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or H.W. Bush. So,
that's
in fact,
right.
The man who's had the success is the man who's out there trying to excite his base to vote. And
that's right.
And so that's, I mean, there are, now, it's going to be a roller coaster. We've had headlines in the last 48 hours, some very unfortunate things, and sort of a nut job in Florida.
Right.
Doing things that are sick and despicable. The parties may attempt to make political gain out of it. I think it's just basically a sick person who shouldn't be out there and available to do terrible things. But everything is political these days, and everybody. Attempts to make some kind of political gain out of it. The fact is that I don't think that's what's going to change the election. Things like Kavanaugh, the Kavanaugh hearing, did change. I don't know exactly what the impact is of the caravan. I do know the caravan will not reach the border in time for the election. So it'll be just a caravan of thousands of people who intend to, from my point of view, invade the United States. Some people think it's a freedom march. But whatever your thoughts, I don't think there's a feeling in Texas and Arizona and other border states that they want thousands and thousands, not only in this march, but if this march were to be successful, and they would crash our border, there'll be millions of people coming north. So
no, and I agree with you on
that.
I
think the president is on the right side here. I think I am a pro-immigration guy.
I
know
too.
You are too. And you and I are both children and grandchildren of people who immigrated. So we respect it. But it's like, for example, I think that the Hispanic community, most Hispanic Americans did legally immigrate.
No,
they've
sure.
done it the old-fashioned way. I think they're as much opposed to illegal immigration or crashing the border as anyone else.
Well, Barry, here's the point. There's at the moment that you and I are talking, there are as many as 3 million people waiting in on a list to enter legally into the United States. So what do you say to those people who are legally waiting, families that are separated because somebody's waiting on a list to come to the United States? How do you explain to those families that they have to wait legally, but these people here can just crash in? So I agree with you. I have no sympathy at all for the caravan. Now, I sympathize for the people. I'm not really mad at the people who are, you know, who are marching, because I think they're being used, frankly. That's my feeling. I think they're being used by people, and it's sad to see that. But I agree with you. I think on this particular case, it's not just good politics for President Trump to do what he's doing. I think it's good policy. You simply cannot allow these caravans to march into your country, and especially with the attitude, Barry. I don't want to get off on the caravan because I know you got other things to say, but the attitude of some of these caravan leaders who are basically saying, we're going in whether you like it or not. Well, that's not. I mentioned in my American Thinker post that this kind of reminded me of the Mexican flags of the immigration marches, that I think all of those Mexican flags did more harm to the immigration reform than anything else, and this caravan is not helping either. Anyway, I didn't mean to get you off with that topic, but let's get back to your analysis. You've mentioned New Jersey and Michigan, so let's keep on.
Well, let's now go to the races that are conventionally competitive. Florida. That's a race. Those are toss-ups. We've got some very interesting candidates. I mentioned earlier that the Republican gubernatorial candidate has made an unusual and very, so far, successful appeal to the Hispanic and Puerto Rican communities and may do much better than I think people think he will do. I think Governor Scott is popular. He handled the recent disaster in the panhandle very well, as he always does. His opponent is an aging senator who does not seem to be a dynamo, but anything could happen. Florida is a purple state, could go either way. In Tennessee, it was supposed to be a possible pickup for the Democrats. The former Democratic governor, and a popular one, Phil Bredesen, was the candidate against Martha Blackburn, but she seems to have built a substantial lead, and the state is basically a very Republican state. In Texas, of course, we've discussed it, another very Republican state. The fourth possible pickup for the Democrats, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think you think so either. The other two states which are the most vulnerable on the Republican side are, of course, Arizona and Nevada, and they could still even go to the Democrats, but in the recent days, the Republicans are picking up their leads. Mr. Beto O'Rourke has got a dilemma with the caravan, because I notice he isn't saying much, because if he were to advocate their being allowed to crash, I think he would lose by 50 points in Texas.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, and Democrats across the country, including those who have been calling for open borders, are keeping their mouths shut because they know that that's not where the country is.
Right, exactly.
That's a no-win argument for them. So they're keeping quiet until after the election. So I think Texas is safe. Arizona, turns out that the Democrat is a little bit of a strange candidate. She's has a past on the far left, saying anti-Arizona things. McSally, the congresswoman, the Republican, is a very, I've met her, she's very impressive. I think she will win, but I don't know it'll be by much. And then Dean Heller in Nevada, I think, is pulled out to a lead. That, too, is very competitive. Harry Reid is still around, still able to motivate Democratic voters, and so it'll be a contest. But I think we have the possibility that the Republicans will not lose even one seat they hold. Now, they may lose one or two, but I think they may also just all, whatever they win from the Democrats will be all net gain. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of seats that are out mm-hmm. there. In addition to Michigan and New Jersey, you have the one place that I don't think that the Republicans are going to pick up is West Virginia.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Mr. Manchin. Now, some people, there's a new poll which shows him behind. I don't believe that. I think Joe Manchin, who's a very conservative Democrat.
He is.
He voted for Kavanaugh. I think that was the decisive vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
If he hadn't, I think he might have been in trouble. But I think he will survive. And I think that conservatives are not particularly upset. He tends to vote half the time with the Republicans anyway.
In fact, I wouldn't be surprised, not to distract you, but I wouldn't be surprised, and I said this to a friend the other day, I wouldn't be surprised if Manchin wins that race. I think he will. And I wouldn't be surprised if he switches parties, like the governor of West Virginia did. Just switches parties and say, you know what, I'm better off being a Republican in West Virginia. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens.
Well, I don't
speculation
think,
on my part. Speculation on my
yeah,
part, but I
would
be
tend
surprised.
To disagree because I thought he had plenty of opportunity to do that to his advantage, and he didn't.
Okay.
He's a long time. He and his family are long time Democrats.
Right. Exactly.
I think he represents a great tradition, which I always had a lot of respect for, which is the moderate Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
The public policy side of Bill Clinton, not his personal side.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a great tradition, Henry Jackson, Hubert Humphrey, people
that's
who were
right.
liberals, but they were moderate in foreign policy, and they were sensible,
mm-hmm.
and they had good ideas. Anyway, so now we go to Indiana, where Donnelly has been very stubbornly holding on to a lead, but that's now disappeared. And
mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that's true is because there's a Libertarian candidate in the race who's taking votes away from Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Braun, but I think Mr. Braun now has a lead.
Yes,
Mr. Donnelly
does.
Voted against Kavanaugh. The president is going to probably be there. I'm not going to make a prediction, but I think there's a chance of a pickup. Now, Dakota's gone. It's over. Double digits. Heidi Heitkamp can look for a new job. Mr. Congressman Kramer will be the next senator. I will predict that. In Montana, Mr. Tester and Mr. Rosendale are in a battle, but the president has basically said to the voters of Montana, 37% of which was the margin he had, listen, this one is important to me. I want Mr. Rosendale to be elected. So he has made
right.
that. He's put it down. He's a red line. And I think if the voters still support the president, I think they do, they will, in the end, vote out Mr. Tester. But Mr. Tester is a very survivor. I have respect for his political ability, and it's not a certainty.
Right.
Mr. Hawley,
yeah, he may
Missouri,
survive. Yeah.
Appears to be pulling away. It will be couldn't be soon enough from my point of view. I thought Ms. McCaskill was not a very good senator. She played
right.
tricks in order to get elected. She's not deserving of re-election, in my view, my subjective view, of course. Your listeners can disagree. But I think...
Well, I agree with you. So you and I are on the same camp on that one. I thought she was really... not to interrupt you, but I thought, for example, in 2012, she got very lucky with her Republican opponent. In 2006, she defeated Jim Talent, and I thought that was terrible because Jim Talent was a really good congressman, but that was, I mean, senator, but that was a bad year for the Republicans, 2006. So she's never been a very impressive senator as far as I'm concerned. So you and I will be happy to see her go, Barry.
And then finally, we have the race in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
yes.
I can tell you that I'm following it with a great, very closely. And Tina Smith, the appointed
mm-hmm.
senator to replace Al Franken, she's a bright, sincere person, but she's not a very good campaigner. And she voted against Kavanaugh, and she's thrown herself in with the left wing of her party, including supporting Ellison, which is a mistake because she made such a big noise about believing Kavanaugh's accuser, which was very much more dubious. Ellison's accuser is much more credible, but she doesn't pay attention to that. And her opponent, Corinne Housley, a state senator, has been pointing that out, that hypocrisy. And the fact is that Corinne Housley is a very good campaigner, but she's being outspent in Minnesota. And Minnesota is a purple state. So the race, but the polls show the race is close to a tie. Tina Smith has a few points lead, but those polls are of some question because we know for a fact, the polls even admit, that they are sampling significantly more Democrats than Republicans. So naturally, you're going to get more of a Democratic vote. So that could be another third upset. It would certainly be an upset if Tina Smith lost, but Corinne Housley is a very good campaigner. And I believe the president will be coming back to the state specifically to campaign for her and Jeff Johnson, the Republican nominee for governor.
Right. And he's a good campaigner from what I've seen. Johnson.
Well, he's turned out to be a surprise. And
that's right.
You know, he was the nominee in 2014 and frankly was not impressive against the man who was elected, Mark Dayton.
Yes.
But this time he's come alive. He defeated Tim Pawlenty.
Yes.
Who had all the money and all the name recognition, and he beat him out of sheer pluck. And he's continuing to do that. He just got his new closing ad is terrific. But he's opposed by a Republican, by a Democrat who has a moderate image, a rural DFL congressman, Tim Walz, who himself, in order to get the nomination, had to move left. And so he turned against the NRA, and of course he's pro-choice. So a lot of the voters, especially outstate and rural, who would be inclined to support him are not going to support him this time. It's going to be very close. That race is also within the margin of error. And we don't know what's going to happen until Election Day. It could go either way. I said at the outset of the program, I'm being very cautious, because when you make predictions that are based on speculation and you try and second-guess the voters may decide in the end they want to turn over control of the House to the Democrats. They almost certainly are not going to turn over control of the Senate. And they certainly aren't going to change the White House until 2020 if that will be their opportunity. But I have a feeling the president is rousing his troops. We can have, I don't think we have a time for another show before the election, but I'm certain we'll have one right afterwards. And we'll see how it turns out.
Right. We will. We'll have one shortly after the election. We may do one before. We'll have to work that out. Maybe we'll work that out off the air and try to do maybe at least a heads up next Friday and see where things are. But I agree with you. I think this is an election where there could be some surprises. I believe in the House, and this is my opinion here as a Republican. Everybody knows I'm a Republican. You're an independent, so I know you in that sense are not as partisan I am, but I'm a Republican, and I believe that if the Democrats were to pick up the House, and they probably have the edge right now, it's not going to be by a lot of votes. And that's going to make their governing very difficult because they have a lot of left-wing influence in their party, and those left-wingers are going to make whoever the speaker is, his or her life, very difficult. And may end up actually electing Trump, helping Trump get reelected in 2020 because of all the crazy things they're going to do. But we'll see what happens on Election Day. I mean, I agree with you. I think there's going to be some surprises. I think the Senate could be three votes for the Republicans, or it could be five or six. I mean, you don't know. We'll know a lot more, I suppose, as we get closer to 10 o'clock on election night. But It's going to be fun to watch, and we'll have to rely on your wisdom as always to to see what's going on. One last question I wanted to ask you, and we don't have a lot of time, but maybe if you could quickly answer this one. I'm very skeptical about polling data these days. And not that I totally disregard the polls. I mean, you tend to look at the trend lines and all of that, but in general, I've become very skeptical because I don't know how in the world you can take a poll in a country where nobody answers the phone, Barry. So if you could take a minute or two and give me your assessment of polls and how valuable they are to your coverage of all these races, Barry.
Well, as you know and my readers know, I'm a longtime critic of recent polling, going back several cycles. The reason being, for you cited, no one's, even though they have phones or have cell phones, whatever, even if they have the phones, and they don't want to answer, especially if they're Republicans or conservatives. Democrats are much more likely to answer and give their answer, but Republicans don't. And, you know, we saw that phenomenon in 2016. People didn't want to admit they were going to vote for Trump, but they did. But the polls, now the polls were, of course, not wrong in the popular vote. They were actually fairly accurate, but they were wrong because the interpretation of them by my colleagues and by the analysts was that they thought that the popular vote would reflect the electoral vote, and of course it didn't. Well, we don't have electoral vote this time, but we don't have a popular vote election. We have a state-by-state election. So the House and Senate and gubernatorial races are by individual states. So if you have the Democrats as they lead in the party thing by 6 or 7 points, what does that mean? Because California, New York, Illinois, and Massachusetts are overwhelmingly Democrat, and those votes superweight the Democratic side, but doesn't tell you those states aren't going to go Republican. They're going to go Democratic for the most part, although there may be some surprises in California on the Republican side. My point is the polling, anyone who knows statistics and real polling knows that if you don't get an answer when you on your first or second call, and you have to go for 4, 5, or 6, or 10 calls before you get an answer, suddenly the statistical accuracy of your poll is wrong. No longer is random in the statistical sense. And then if your people who do answer aren't going to tell you the truth,
mm-hmm.
as many do, because either deliberately or because they don't want to admit what they're going to do. For example, in New Jersey, if you're Hispanic and you get called, are you going to vote for Menendez or Hogan? And you're going to vote for Hogan, but you're Hispanic American, and Menendez is too. You're not going to admit what you're going to do. You're still going to do it,
mm-hmm.
but you're reluctant to tell somebody, especially if they call you live, because you don't know who's on the other end of the line.
Right, right.
And
I wonder if we have the same impact down here with Beto.
Right.
When they call in South Texas, I wonder if people say they're going to vote for Beto, but not really do so. This just based on what you were explaining right now.
So the polls. Now that just. But one other thing I need to be fair. What have I always written for years and years is that although the polling is can be way off, and it was, for example, in the primaries in Minnesota, way, way off, mm-hmm. statistically impossibly to rationalize, up until the end, at the very end, the pollsters, when they look at their data, they can see trends. And if they see trends going away, contrary to what they have been reporting in earlier polls, they're going to adjust their polls to be more accurate, because they don't want to be embarrassed. If you say,
right.
as has happened here in Minnesota, by the way, historically, if you say candidate A is going to win by 15 points and he loses by 10, and your poll was taken the weekend before the election, you're out of business.
That's right.
You have no credibility. So nobody's
going
to do that.
That's what, like Nate Silver saying that Hillary Clinton had a 93% chance of winning. Well, that's a credibility boost. I mean, destroyer when... when she ends up losing. But I'm not picking on Nate Silver. I'm just bringing that up
as an example. Nate Silver's actually a smart guy, and I respect him in many ways. But he's a partisan. He's a cheerleader for the Democrats. Now, he goes out of his way to try and be fair, unlike some of the other pollsters. Look at Nate Cohen, who's the pollster for the New York Times, the New York Times Siena polls. So the New York Times Siena poll in the Minnesota 8th District 6 weeks ago had the Republican down 1 point, which everybody knew was ridiculous. The same identical poll 4 weeks later had the Republican up 15 points.
Right, right.
Why? Because they realized that they hadn't taken a very good sample, so then they decided they would be much more careful, and of course then they got a much more reasonable solution.
Right.
Now, I don't know how that's going to turn out, but we all knew that that race was over. The Democratic Party withdrew from that race 2 weeks ago, withdrew 1.2 million in ads, and essentially have thrown in the towel.
Right. That's right. Well, Barry, we're just about out of time, but obviously we're going to get back to you. Hopefully, maybe we'll do another quick look at the election before, and then, of course, definitely after we will do an analysis of the election. But as always, thank you so much for your time. It's always a great delight to chat with you and to have you on the program. It just teaches us a great deal, and I learned so much just listening to you and hearing many of your explanations, because I know you are a very serious man who takes all of this very, very seriously, and I appreciate that very much. So keep up the great work with the Prairie Editor. We always recommend it to everyone we talk to, and we'll keep reading what you're saying and what you're writing, and we'll see where we are on Election Day, Barry.
Well, the pleasure was mine. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much. My good friend, Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor, absolutely one of the best sources in the country when it comes to analyzing elections. I can tell you that I check a lot of sources because I enjoy it and like to read what a lot of people are writing. But Barry Castleman is very good, and the Prairie Editor is an absolutely amazing resource. So check him out, and if you're not a subscriber, I would strongly, strongly encourage you to become a subscriber. I am, and I enjoy it a great deal getting these reports from Barry from time to time. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and I'm hoping that the Dodgers will tie the series tonight. We'll see how that works. Good night, everybody.